Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. How are you, sir?
Doing well. Happy to be here. Excited. Shout out to all the dunkers. Thank you for embracing your bounce. Here with a very excited Nikias, one of the most brilliant minds in our game today. And I feel like we're going to get a lot of Chris Middleton energy. So I'm ready to harness that, and let's have some fun tonight.
Yeah. Well, who's to say? The jury's out right now. 29-75. Just a thing that one does in the finals to help give his team a 3-2 lead, a pivotal 3-2 lead in the series. Yeah, we'll talk about it.
Sounds like the jury's in, my friend.
we don't know yet. You know, job not finished. So we'll see what happens over the next two games if necessary. But again, we'll talk more about the finals. Very happy to be here with the one, the only Steve Jones Jr., one of, if not the best X's and O's guy on Twitter right now. Completely overqualified to do so, if I should say so myself. But happy to be here as always. I'm ready to get yelled at some point in this pod, and we'll see where it goes. I'm in a good mood. And yeah, we're vibing today.
No yelling over here. The hashtag is Big Calm.
Big Calm. Okay. Got to add that to the t-shirt line. Speaking of which, the Dunker Spot has merch. T-shirts, hoodies, coffee mugs. More designs coming in at some point. So stay tuned for that. But if you would like a shirt, hoodie, whatever, go to shop.basketballnews.com. Check out the store, not just the Dunker Spot, Dishes and Dimes, Neat and Unfiltered, the Rex Chapman Show, the Postcast. We have all kinds of podcasts and have all kinds of different podcasts to support if you want to do so. So please check out the store, check out the site, get some stuff, have some fun. We're up to good folks at basketballnews.com. That is my plug for today. Let's talk some
that's the only one? That's the one plug?
That is the singular plug.
Okay.
All right. On the podcast, at least, you know. My timeline's gonna turn into a freaking bot account. You know, we'll see.
Go get your merch, folks.
Embrace your bounce and also your checkbooks, you know, your Apple Pays, your Cash Apps, your Venmos, whatever you need, your PayPals. You know, whatever method you need to choose. You know, help us pay some bills. You know, have an awesome logo on your chest.
Help Nikias get another PS5.
Don't call me out like this. We don't have to do that. That is not a thing that had to be said on this here podcast. Anyway, before we get into some finals talk, we do have a little bit of news. The NBA and the Players Association have agreed to bring back the play-in tourney for next season. We've talked about this a little bit before on the podcast, but just as a refresher, where are you on the idea of the play-in tournament?
It's great. I love the play-in tournament. There's no surprise to me it's coming back. I mean, it increased the value of the regular season, both bag-wise and competition-wise. You had more teams looking to fight to stay in their positions and avoid the play-in. Which helped the integrity of the game. We weren't talking about tanking towards the end of the season. We were talking about positioning. We were talking about who can make a push. You know, you saw what Washington did as far as making a different kind of push than normally they would have made. Had it been a regular season, more teams were battling. More teams were trying to make moves midseason to try and stay in it. Look at a trade like Chicago made. Didn't really work out, but they were trying to make a push as well. And we had a great playing experience. The East wasn't so great, but I mean, that Western Conference pretty much sealed the deal. So you get a week worth of games with stakes before the playoffs start. It seems like a win. So I'm excited to see it come back. I'm excited to see how it evolves, what the base is for it, what it looks like with different teams. I think, you know, we're probably not going to see LeBron and Steph every year, but it's going to be fun to see more teams continuing to compete and continuing to strive and what that looks like in those close situations to try and get in the playoffs. So, and just wait until one of those playing teams maybe wins the series. Never know.
Could be fun. I'm right there with you. Like, I think this season was obviously a success. If you can get, again, if you get a primetime Steph versus LeBron game, I think you take that 10 out of 10 times. And as you said, the NBA can't expect that. But if you can make the regular season matter a little bit more, of course you do that. Something that I've said on the pod before, something I'm looking to see, as you mentioned, you know, if you make the point about evolving, like I want to see what the parameters are going to be moving forward. Because I just wish that they had some kind of like games back minimum. Just to.
Out the window, buddy. Out the window, pal. It's over for that.
It's done. And I can see why, but like that, I think if you really want to bump up the competition level, at least, then I think that would make more sense. It adds a little bit of fairness. Isn't the word I really want to use, but it's the best word I can think of right now. But the fairness for like those top two seeds. So it isn't an automatic that they're basically coming in, you know, later into the game planning process as they wait for these teams to duke it out and see who they're actually going to face in the first round. So that kind of thing, I think it'd be cool. And even just for the seventh seed, like if they have a 6-game lead over the 10 seed, then they shouldn't have to worry about a play-in game, I don't think. But outside of that, the excitement, the intrigue, again, the tanking point you made was an astute one. I'm not surprised that it's back. I just want to see that alteration at least.
I mean, if you're 6 games ahead of the 10 seed, then you should probably be able to make it in. If you trick the first game off and you lose that same 10 seed, you got to go home. Sorry.
I mean, I get it. But like, on one hand, the play-in tournament or the existence of the play-in tournament is making the regular season matter more. But also, if you build that kind of lead over that kind of a sample, like I also don't love the idea of like a 2-game stretch potentially taking you out the postseason.
Do you know who loves it? The TV companies.
Yeah, and, like, I mean, Wendy's going to win out. It is what it is. I definitely get it, but
they're not taking the maybe we'll have 2 games this year. Nah, fam. Give me my 4 games this week.
Shout out capitalism. It's fine. Anyway, in other news, Washington has hired a head coach. Wes Unseld Jr. is getting the job. Has been an assistant, a highly regarded assistant for a long time. So I'm interested to see what he does with the Washington job. What's going to happen with the Russell Westbrook Bradley Beal backcourt? We'll talk about Bradley Beal very shortly. But what were your initial thoughts when you saw that news come through the wire?
It was a big time salute. I mean, just for Wes Unseld Jr. to have that kind of homecoming, you don't necessarily see that in this business. Obviously, the great Wes Unseld Sr. was a Bullets/Wizards legend. And Wes Unseld Jr. was someone who spent a lot of time with that franchise. And for him to spend that much time to go elsewhere and to be able to come back as the head coach, that's a special moment. And it's a great opportunity for him, you know, just to be able to have your first shot, be somewhere you've been before, and continuing the trend as far as we've seen assistant coaches getting first time opportunities this season. We've seen Black assistant coaches getting their first opportunities this season. So it's a salute to him. I think this is obviously a dream that he's been looking to realize and be able to realize it in Washington. That's got to be exciting. So I want to, more so than anything, X's and O's play style wise, salute to him. That's a moment.
He absolutely deserves that moment. I'll be rooting for him. That's a great story. Of course, I am curious about what the X's and O's are going to be. Like, that Washington roster is interesting, I think is a fair way to describe it. Again, you have the obvious star power at the top, and then it's talent, but like talent with some interesting fits. And I think their offseason is going to be one interesting one to track. Like, the obvious thing is, will the Bradley Beal trade rumors continue? Even though Bradley Beal has said at every turn that he doesn't want to go anywhere. So it's very much manufactured, but that's probably going to pop up again. So we'll see. And just trying to build around that, trying to find the right mix of defenders around those two, trying to find a play style that fits everyone. Like, that's not an easy job for a first time head coach to take with those kind of personalities, with that kind of star power, and just the roster construction in general right now. So I just want to see like what that front office does to kind of help him in that first year.
I'm very curious with the direction as well, because this is the type of job that could potentially be better than it looks on paper. But this is also the type of job where what you signed up for isn't there shortly after you signed up for it. So it'll be interesting there. I imagine that the defense will be the number one thing that he preaches just based on his role with Denver. And Washington needs that. They need to get a bump defensively.
Yes.
So it'll be very interesting to see there. But I mean, it's going to be based on the roster. So like you said, that's going to be the number one thing. And I want to see what it looks like. I think we'll get a more competitive team. But again, I don't know if it's going to be the team that we have now or if both of those guys are going to be gone.
Yeah, I hope he doesn't get the carpet pulled from under him like that, because this is basically what happened to Steven Silas in Houston last year, where he finally gets the head coaching job and Russ gets traded. James Harden eventually gets traded. John Wall is there and then he isn't. And it's just a bunch of turmoil there. So I'm curious to see what year two is going to look like for him, especially with, and we'll get into some draft talk at some point over the next couple of weeks or so, but pivotal draft for Houston, but that's going off script right now. Very happy for Wes Unseld Jr. in Washington. That is going to be a fun team to track, regardless of how it goes. If they build upon the roster that they have and kind of make try to take that next step, or if it does blow up, just to see how that gets navigated. But we already kind of touched on Bill, so we'll slide right into some Team USA news. Bradley Beal will not be on this year's Olympic team. He's out. Kevin Love is also out. Jeremy Grant isn't out right now, but he's technically out because he's in health and safety protocols. But replacing Bradley Beal and Kevin Love are Keldon Johnson of the San Antonio Spurs, a dunker spot favorite, to say the least, and JaVale McGee, in which Steve and I had the exact same reaction to the news. Like, what was it, like 30 minutes apart?
It's 2 hours. Send me my check.
I did not see your tweet, so it's just a very raw, you know, I was also confused at the addition. Like, first and foremost, I can't believe a Plumlee didn't get a roster spot. I thought one was just reserved for them.
I can't do the bit this episode. got yelled at in the reviews.
Did you actually?
Yeah, I ruined it. I ruined our reviews, so my bad.
Oh no! Wait a minute. I wasn't aware of this. Who? What was the wait?
Yeah, 4.9 now. Sorry, my guy.
Oh no! We've been ruined because of the age bit. That's tough.
Is that Mason Plumlee slander? that wasn't gonna stop me.
It doesn't hit the same. We can't. Oh man.
JaVale McGee, I think that's awesome. I was like, wait a minute, I wasn't expecting it. That came out of nowhere. But I think that's pretty cool. The Keldon Johnson part, that wasn't a surprise. I kind of called that a little bit just after watching the exhibition games. Sadiq Bey and Darius Garland kind of got the, what you like to call good for him minutes.
Yes.
And Keldon Johnson slowly got the, wait, does Pop know he's not on the team minutes? And so it looked like, okay, if something, he might just make the team anyways. So I thought Keldon Johnson can have an impact on both ends. I think activity defensively, guard multiple positions. I think his ability to drive and his physicality there is going to be important in the international game. He's just another piece to give them versatility. That stinks for Bradley Beal. I hope he's all right. That's no good to sign up for that. Now you don't get the opportunity to go. And for Kevin Love, I was surprised. You know, I thought this was going to be a great environment for him to kind of get back on the right foot going into the season. And if anyone kind of needed that Olympic bump, it was probably going to be him. Mm-hmm. It's kind of unfortunate. He felt he wasn't ready or couldn't contribute at the level he wanted to, type deal. But JaVale McGee is the type of player they need as far as a big. I mean, Draymond, Bam, and Jeremy Grant are great, and mixing and matching those guys are great, but a true big will help. Traditional coverages, role, a rebounder, and what a legacy he could have as far as flipping from Shaqton to champion to an Olympic gold medalist. Yeah. that, like, we didn't, I don't think there's a soul that saw that coming. There's usually a tweet somewhere out there that predicts these things. I don't think anyone could find the JaVale McGee Team USA one. I don't know if that's happening. Also cool because, you know, his mother, Pamela McGee, won a gold medal, I believe, in 84. And now he's got a chance to win one now. That would be a unique bond. So salute to JaVale. I'm sure he's going to be excited and happy to be there. And I'm sure he's going to be the direct result of any and all memes if Team USA falls short.
Yeah, that's that's probably how it's going to go, unfortunately for him. But no, it's he obviously feels a role. Like, they need they need a rim roller. I'm not going to echo everything you said because you pretty much hit on it. But, like, JaVale feels an obvious need. Very excited for Keldon Johnson. Like, just his brand of physicality and fearlessness, I think, is needed. Because Team USA, as currently constructed, like, they have a lot of shot creators, a lot of guys that can get to the pull-up when necessary. They do have guys that can drive, but not necessarily someone with that kind of rim frequency that Keldon Johnson provides. And the fact that he can defend is an obvious plus for a Team USA squad through the exhibition games that did not defend on the perimeter particularly well. So I think he's obviously going to help there. Though I understand the JaVale pick and the role that he feels, like, I'm still surprised that he was the guy. Like, I thought they would have tapped into any of the, well, this is just going to lean into the bit, but, like, I figured they would have went into some of the team, like, the select team guys. Like, maybe you look at, like, a Jaren Jackson Jr. or someone like that. Any of the younger bigs in the pool. But JaVale fits. And like I said earlier, like, I'm also surprised that that just wasn't a Mason Plumlee call since he already has the experience with Team USA. But good for JaVale. Very excited for Keldon. We'll see if Team USA can get it together, because just the exhibition stuff that we saw from them was odd, to say the least.
I mean, it looks like a group of guys coming off a long season who just came together and started playing games 6 days later. Like, I feel like the discourse is kind of off there. I mean, for me, I don't have expectations right now. The big thing is they have to continue to build and get better. Defensively, there are some positives as far as they're switching, keeping everything in front. But it's one of those things where they have to kind of have the nuance and the awareness around it and behind it to make it pop more. And they've done it in flashes, but other times they've been caught by surprise by pull-ups and handoffs and those kind of things. Teams are more aware and ready to throw it into the post and play out of it. So I think it makes sense for Team USA to have an automatic switch scheme, but also it kind of hurts them just being a total automatic, because teams can kind of exploit that and go at it. And I think the other thing for this particular Team USA team is they're not necessarily great at one particular thing. So as they get better and play, it's going to be a grind. You know, they can defend, but it comes in spurts. They can score, but how do they generate quality looks consistently? They can get out in transition, but it's not like an automatic every game. So they're going to have to find the one thing they're good at, and they're going to have to pound that, you know, left and right. So it'll be interesting to see how they grow. It's, I mean, the international game is different. It's tougher. These teams have played together. These teams are better. I mean, if you look at the teams that Team USA placed exhibition-wise, a lot of NBA players out there, a lot of NBA talent, a lot of guys looking to beat Team USA. So they're going to have to get on their horse. They're going to have to get better. But I imagine things will improve. But as we saw last time they competed, it may not be enough. They may figure it out. It's just going to be kind of a, like, I don't want to say a 50-50 type deal, but they got some work to do.
Yeah, they do. And you make the point that the international game is different. How have you felt about the discourse about FIBA officiating or Olympic officiating compared to what the NBAers are used to in the States?
I mean, I don't love the discourse. I just think it's a different ball game. You're not going to get some of those calls, and you might get some of them at different times. I mean, the drives, you're going to have to drive with force and finish. And, you know, the foul calls aren't going to be the same automatic they are in the league. So you got to adjust to that and drive with purpose. You know, some of the other drives necessarily won't have the same impact, but the game is different. The coverages are a little bit different. I mean, you have bigs doing show and recover, which you can't do in the NBA anymore. Mm-hmm. That used to be the go-to coverage for bigs who could pick and pop and shoot and teams carve that up. But in the international game, you can get away with that. There's a lot more help on drives. There's a lot more set and recover rotations, that kind of thing. So I think for me, it's them making that adjustment to those differences, because while they have the talent, they don't necessarily have, I don't want to say they can't bend the defense, but teams are sticking with their base a lot more than I think you would anticipate. So be interesting to see how they move going forward.
Are you okay with Team USA's current hierarchy in terms of like their offensive firepower right now? I think it's very clear it's still a Durant-led team, and it feels like Tatum's kind of number two right now. And they're just kind of pulling that one.
No, I don't have a problem with it. I think it's more them understanding each other and knowing when someone has it going, how to get them going, what spots to get them going in. I mean, when you have a lineup out there with Dame, KD, and Tatum, you should be able to generate something, but sometimes it appears like guys are overpassing. Got shots that they would take off a drive. Maybe they're taking another drive, and so that's allowing the defense a beat to recover. They might pass up another shot. Now they're taking another drive. So the drive and kick is fine, but do they have to take it to the next level and understand when can we punish teams? You know, when can we generate something for someone else, and when can we take that shot? Right. I feel like they haven't necessarily hit that balance consistently in the exhibition season, but it's improved as they've gone along.
All right. And while we're on Team USA, we'll flow to one of their other members. Damian Lillard was in the news this week. There was reportedly a trade request. That trade request was shut down by Lillard himself after a Team USA practice. But as he continues to talk about his situation in Portland, he makes the point. I mean, he just kind of flat out said, like, the Portland team as constructed is not good enough to win a title, which is probably true. But also, I can't imagine how that's going to go over in the locker room. Like, I think that's just an interesting idea. It's just been a weird time in Portland in general for very obvious reasons. And Dame has mostly out of his, I mean, it hasn't really been his fault, but like he's now kind of been centered in the turmoil in Portland. So I'm curious of your thoughts on how that situation is going down right now.
For me, I think it's weird. It's weird stuff. It feels forced almost. You ever watch like your favorite TV show and there's a storyline that just doesn't feel right, feels out of place? This feels like that. Like, it's clear Dame wants to win, and we know Dame has been loyal and thinks he can win there, and it's clear that he thinks what we have is not enough. And I feel like all those things can exist without so much of the noise. Like, oh, here's a trade request, and Dame's like, no, I'm not doing that. So it's like, what are we doing here? And now, you know, speculation runs wild. So we've got 7-8 other things going on that come out, and then Dame's like, no, that's not accurate. And that's like, what are we doing here? I don't know if we're quite at that point. I think he's frustrated. I think he wants to win, and I think he wants to see what they're going to do around him. This is the first time he maybe has put, I don't want to say his foot down, but it's the first time he's probably pressed the button. You know, because it's been all, I don't want to say rainbows and sunshine, but he's been loyal. Hey, I'm trying to win. We can get it done. And I think that Denver loss took a hit a little bit, belief-wise. So, hey, we need to make some changes. And I don't think that's something that anyone would disagree with. Whatever version of that roster is may have hit its peak or ran its course, so they have to do something different. And for some reason, that spread like wildfire into all of this, where he hasn't made any firm decisions on what his future will be. I mean, there's no right answer for Dame right now. Once you hit the zone of you want out, there's no right answer. Everything is just smoke and fire.
Yeah, you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube at that point. And I get his frustration because, I mean, it's not like Portland's been a bad team. Like, they've made a conference finals. They've been a consistent playoff presence. But as you mentioned, like, losing to that Denver squad who, you know, they have the MVP, but, you know, no Murray, no Barton for a lot of the series, just missing pretty much, like, pretty much most of their guard rotation. and to lose that series with Dame also going nuclear in said series, of course he's going to take a hit. Like, even the most loyal people are going to look at something like that. Like, all right, what are we really doing? And, you know, Dame isn't washed or anything like that, but he is getting later into his career. And so I could see him finally reaching the point like, okay, like, we need something drastic to be done. Or maybe I need to be placed somewhere else where it's more realistic for me to make a move. And he doesn't seem to be at that point. And again, to your point, it does kind of feel forced. I do feel like people want that speculation. Like, they want the big transaction. That's natural. Like, you want to see fireworks. We're coming off a season in which James Harden got traded to Brooklyn. Like, we're seeing more and more super duos, super teams over the past, you know, 10, 15 years be formed in the NBA. So it's natural to see a guy like Dame kind of read the tea leaves and then just continue to think about, speculate and talk about it. And kind of, I don't want to say speaking into existence, because I mean, fans only have so much power, right? In a literal sense, but you can kind of see the writing on the wall. And Dame might not be at that point, but it seems like the public is kind of there already and they want to see Dame in a winning situation. They don't believe it's Portland. And as currently constructed, that Portland roster is absolutely not a title contender in the West. They're a good playoff team. And that can't be, for a guy of Dame's caliber, like, he's not going to be content with that as the ceiling at a certain point.
No, I think he's getting older. I think he understands the situation. I think he just spoke up on it. And because of where we're at, as far as speculation goes, it kind of just ran with it. I mean, there were people who were talking about Dame to certain places during the season. You know, I guess Knicks was one of them, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. Or, hey, they got to get him out of Portland. That's kind of the thing that they run with. But, I mean, even if you read what Dame said to Chris Haynes, you know, if you do what you've always done, you'll always be where you've always been. So, I mean, his words say it all. I think he wants to be better. He wants to compete and he wants to let it be known. Hey, I'm happy to fight here. I'm willing to do it, but we've got to all get on the same page and we all got to make improvements. And it just took off, but it's just weird. Discourse is weird.
It is weird. I'll ask you this, because we don't get super deep into trade rumors on the show, so I don't want to hang here too long.
The rumor spot.
We're absolutely not going to be the rumor spot. But one of the common packages I've seen, and like from my view, I think more would have to be added from Portland side, just because for whatever. But anyway, like, if Portland and Philadelphia were to talk and they were able to, if there was some kind of McCollum plus package for Ben Simmons, like, do you think something like that moves the needle for Portland or for Dame specifically? Or do you think they have to try to swing even bigger than that?
I just think they got to win. I think it may be just having more pieces around him more than just getting one person, to me. Because if you swing for the fences, get a guy, even if Ben Simmons is just one person, it doesn't work. Now what do you do? Mm-hmm. You know, so they've got to just do whatever they can to put the best roster out there and give themselves the best chance to win. And winning solves most of everything. I just don't know if that's the move that's going to be like, ah, yeah, we're good. They gotta build this thing out a little bit.
I feel that. Like, I just think about Portland's roster, and I do think in a broad sense, like, defense is more of the issue than anything, because that was not a good defensive team at all. And it's frustrating from their perspective, because it's not like that happened from a lack of effort. Like, they traded for Robert Covington, they added Derrick Jones Jr. Like, they added a bunch of pieces to fill out the bench last offseason. Like, I think we were both pretty optimistic about Portland heading into the season because of the moves that they made. And the defense just was not there for the majority of the season last year. So I think if they're going to swing in the trade market in particular, like, I do think it's going to be for someone that can help bolster the defense and help anchor it in that way. So that's why my first thought, and one of the common swaps that's kind of been thrown out there, has been like McCollum and stuff for Simmons. It's really just been McCollum for Simmons. But again, like, you add in, you look at Ben's resume, his age, like I think Portland would probably have to give up a little bit more in that deal. But at any rate, that's kind of what I'm thinking. But from the free agent side, I could definitely see him going that path, just kind of trying to fill out the bench with more defenders. I think the shot creation is there. Like, I mean, Dame is basically a top 10 offense onto himself because of the way that he can shoot, the way that he pulls up, the way that he drives, the passing that complements all of that. He's one of the most dangerous offensive players the league has ever seen. So I think if you have Dame, you're going to have a good offense. It's just finding the right pieces to complement that so you can get enough stops so you can get to Dame time, quote unquote, and he can close out games for you. So if they don't make the swing, either if it's a big trade swing or if it's just adding more minor pieces in free agency, like the defense is going to be what drives whatever success they're going to have this season and moving forward.
I mean, reckless speculation. I just think it's having a roster that can bend a little bit. Through every step of the way, it feels like they've been able to get solved at some point or another, whether it's not having enough offensive pieces on the floor so teams can guard them a certain way, or not having enough size, or not having enough defensive wings, whatever it is. I think it's more so just trying to fill those plugs. But I'm recklessly speculating, and I'm not good at it. So,
so you're telling me this is not the reckless speculation spot? Doesn't even fall off the tongue.
Pulled that one off your foot.
Yeah, it's just, you know. Yeah, it'd be like that sometimes, you know. Just got to get back on defense, you know, hike up the shorts, dig in.
You got to slap the floor. All right,
yeah,
gotcha. Man,
yeah, you got to, you know, got to show some grit. Drop that just for you. I just want to see what your reaction was going to be.
You going to say grind? Is that your next line?
Not yet. Side note,
y'all give me all sorts of trouble for the puns I drop. There may or may not have been someone who said after a Jay Crowder dunk, I call him Slam Crowder.
Who said that?
I'm not naming names, but
what?
There's your segue to finals talk. I just want to throw it out there. Slam Crowder. No idea what it means. Like it sounded good once it was said, but then I was like, wait a minute.
Slam Crowder.
His name is Jay.
But it's just going off of Clam Chow. Like I'm very confused that the Milwaukee Bucks lost the first two games of the NBA Finals. They have won three straight. They are one win away from their first championship since Lou Alcindor was a member of the squad, which should tell you how long ago that was. Giannis has remained incredible. Jrue Holiday made layups and also jump shots in game five. Jrue Holiday made layups in game five.
Yeah, you might owe that man an apology.
I wouldn't go that far. He should already be making layups, but it was a welcome sight to see him not finishing at the rim as he has been all regular season long and throughout most of the postseason. Like the layup yips thing was just very weird. So it was nice for him to just have a bounce back game where everything just kind of course corrected. The layups went down. Again, with the layups going down, like the rim pressure obviously persisted. That's been a constant throughout the series. He just hasn't made the shots. He made the shots in game five. The pull-up was there. Like, there was a transition attempt after a loose ball where he matched up with Devin Booker. And instead of driving, he just kind of steps back into a three and catches it. And it's just like, okay, Jrue is feeling himself. Which, as we've talked about during that Bucks-Nets series, like, that kind of got him into trouble sometimes when he goes into the and one mixtape bag. But Jrue had himself a night in game five. Pat Connaughton, timely boards, timely three-pointers. Bobby Portis looking comfortable on switches, knocking down timely three-pointers, timely offensive rebounds. I feel like I'm missing someone. Ah, P.J. Tucker. Solid defense. Brooke Lopez also defended well. Some solid reps in the drop. Played a little bit higher at times. What's going on?
I'm waiting for the cherry on top of this one right here.
Uh, the cherry would be like the Jeff Teague minutes, but
I thought you were definitely gonna drop Jeff Teague minus 11. I thought that was definitely
coming. Oh, that was next. That was next. Society has progressed past the need for Jeff Teague minutes.
I really enjoy that in your rampage as to crown Chris Middleton and your praise of the Bucks, that you still somehow find a way to throw Jeff Teague over the top rope. Man gets his two little 4-minute runs and he's still killing him.
He gets 2 4-minute runs and the team gets outscored. I don't know what you want me to do with that. It's not my fault. I'm not playing him.
He's about to be a champion. He's one game away from being a champion.
In spite of, I don't. Yeah, I just. A minus 11 in 7 minutes in a 4-point win is hard to do.
Sounds to be like that, man. So Milwaukee, Drew Holiday. That aggression paid off. What were you most impressed by? Because Drew Holiday, you mentioned, it wasn't just the layups, it was the pull-ups. He very rarely has stopped being aggressive. You mentioned sometimes he gets himself in trouble, sometimes he gets in his own way, sometimes he makes it tougher than it needs to be, mm-hmm. but he's never looked passive or afraid of the moment. Mm-hmm. You go back to that Brooklyn game 7 where he couldn't make anything and then he was making big shots left and right. He's continued to put that pressure on, and his ability to drive has been huge this series. Now he added the finishing to it, and then he added the shot making. And I'm sure we'll dig into it, but goodness gracious, the shot making from Milwaukee in game 5 was incredible, tough to deal with. But ultimately, when Drew has it going, when Middleton has it going, when Giannis has it going, this team looks completely different. You don't need necessarily me to explain that to you, but that opens what Milwaukee wants to do up. You know, we talk about the process for them offensively and how they could maybe be better or get out of their own way. I thought they came in waves. I mean, it took a lot of shot making, but they came in waves as far as running different actions, running different sets, putting guys in different positions and alternating. Middleton with the ball, Drew with the ball, Giannis. Now we're mixing up who's screening. We go to the elbow action. Maybe it's Middleton screening in the middle of the floor for Giannis. Maybe it's Giannis screening for Middleton on the side. Maybe it's Drew playing out of it with either one of them. Drew to a post up. Like, I feel like they were able to mix and match because all three of those guys were in flow. All three of those guys were in a rhythm, which made it incredibly tough. And I thought that for me, Phoenix just had a tough time guarding the players after the action. And Milwaukee made them pay on almost every look they took in that second half. I wouldn't even say it was bad defense. I wouldn't even necessarily say it was the actions that put the pressure on. Milwaukee just made those shots. They went out and got those buckets. So a lot to unwrap, a lot to uncover. But I was trying to get my stuff in before you talked about Chris Middleton.
I will start off the Christmas. It's not even a victory lap. It's, I guess this
it's the 8th victory lap. You're on a victory mile.
I don't know about that. This is like the, it's the pacer test for like victory laps. You know, we aren't. What is this? We got a pacer test reference on the pod. It's fine.
This is this victory lap is like a 4x400 relay for you.
Yeah, pretty accurate. No, but I'll kick off the Chris Middleton talk with a point that you made on a recent pod, to where we were talking about Chris Middleton's shot make, just the way that Phoenix was defending Chris Middleton in general. And you posed the question, like, could Middleton or Milwaukee's offensive design, some combination of the two, could they do enough to kind of break Phoenix from going to single coverage with Middleton? And could he not just make shots, but bend their defense? And in game 5, Phoenix just ramped up the pressure in general, but also did so against Middleton specifically. A lot more double teams, a lot more shows against him, more aggressive help against him. And now, I think we talked about this after the game 4 pod. Like, I understand fundamentally why Phoenix would try to crowd Middleton and send an extra defender just to test out the passing and the decision-making. because Milwaukee doesn't have a great pass on the roster. They have a few good ones. But with Middleton in particular, because of the handle and just because of just the passing ability in general, like, I get the gamble of sending two and seeing if he can make you pay. But he made them pay in game four. They ramped up the pressure in game five, and he consistently made them pay. And then when he got single coverage, he was able to knock down a bunch of tough shots. So you got the best of both worlds if you're Milwaukee. Not only do you have your best perimeter shot creator knocking down the shots that are well within his wheelhouse, he's also getting more aggressive coverage, and he's making not only the right pass, but he's making the right pass on time and scrambling Phoenix's defense. And at a certain point, like, Phoenix just doesn't have enough answers. Like, they can't come into a game with like an inherent size slash paint disadvantage. Like, as good as Phoenix has been all year long, if you look at their offensive profile, like, they're not a team that got to the rim or the free throw line a lot. So they're already kind of beating you with tougher looks, if that makes sense. And Milwaukee just beats you to death in the paint. They get to the rim a ton. They finish at the rim well. They get to the free throw line a ton. And then you add in the offensive rebounding because of the collective size that they have. And, like, you're already kind of at a losing battle. So once you factor that in and then you send extra pressure and you're putting your defense in rotation on top of already being at this kind of size disadvantage, like, Phoenix is struggling to take away something. In game five, you know, get that impressive shot-making blend from Milwaukee. Like, it just felt like nothing got taken away from Milwaukee at a certain point.
Well, the shot-making is tough to take away because they're hitting the looks that you're living with or you're okay with living with, and it's not necessarily the actions of the sets. The secret sauce is Milwaukee being able to get to dribble penetration whenever they want and crashing the glass. So the paint touches and the offensive rebounds are key. This man is excited. We went right from Chris Middleton talk to Milwaukee offensive rebounding talk in 0.2 seconds. I love it. But back to your Middleton point, this is something we've talked about on this podcast before. I know technically I've said it many a time. You cannot let Chris Middleton be a shot maker and a playmaker. If he is making you pay with his ability to make those tough shots and that brings your defense up and you put two on the ball and he can now make plays, that's a problem. And I felt like what Milwaukee has done from the start of this series to now is they went from a team that could not find a pressure point, save their life in the first two games, to dictating the flow and being able to generate help from multiple players, whether it's Middleton coming off screens or handoffs, whether it's Giannis on the side, ISOs or post-ups. You saw they went from doubling Giannis to not doubling Giannis, whether it's Drew Holiday having it going and how they're helping on his drives. That changed the game for Milwaukee because that allowed them to do what they do, but also generate easier looks, generate more quality looks, get Phoenix in rotation. You cannot, it hasn't worked anytime Phoenix has tried to do it with Middleton. Anytime they put two on the ball, it just opens everything up. And that's where you have to salute Chris Middleton for making the shots needed to make Phoenix feel like they can't live with it. Phoenix wants to live with contested Chris Middleton jump shots. We've seen that. We've seen them go to the switching. We've seen them go to helping from the wing. We've seen them do whatever they can to say, hey, you take this shot. We know you're going to take it. We're going to make it contested. It's going to be tough. He's made too many, and the game flow has not allowed Phoenix to be comfortable with it. So now they think, hey, we got to ramp it up a little bit. We got to take him away. And they've just turned the volume up a little bit too much every time they do it. It's not like Ayton's at the level. He's jumping out, which is, again, putting two on the ball, which is opening everything up for Milwaukee. So they've got to find that middle ground, just like Milwaukee had to find that middle ground early in this series with Chris Paul, with Devin Booker, and guarding them in pick and roll. But Atlanta learned the lesson. If Chris Middleton is doing both those things, Milwaukee is a completely different team.
And in this case, not just a completely different team, a team that is on the cusp of winning a title. So I guess my question to you, like, what is the middle ground for Phoenix? Like, I think, as you mentioned, like, how high Ayton is showing on some of these traps, though, like, he can't be the guy to do it. Not because he doesn't have the ability to do so, but because he's the only player with real size on the court for Phoenix. And if he's playing that high and that pass is made and you're scrambling with Ayton at the three-point line, a Milwaukee team that already wants to get to the paint now does not have to worry about your best rim protector. So I'm just curious, like, what is the answer for Phoenix defensively?
Literally, they could try him in between, have him at the level and then drop back, as opposed to either being deep or being active and trapping almost. Mm-hmm. Or they could even switch if they wanted to and just say, hey, we're just still going to try and contest and keep it in front. But they can't give the deep drop and then the aggressive coverage once Chris Middleton's in rhythm. They've got to be able to pick one. So I'd probably say they need to just be more aware, more active, try and crowd the space, try and make it as tough as possible. But again, that switch to having Middleton handle the ball changed the series for him. You know, Bridges was having a great time. Well, I shouldn't say great time. He was having success denying the actions, the off-ball actions. Once the ball was in his hand, he's chasing almost every time. He's done a good job of fighting over a few screens, and they've had some switches that have worked out. But ultimately, they've got to find the coverage to take away those sweet spots. And even if they don't, I mean, he's going to make tough shots. You just have to be able to live with them. I mean, and if Phoenix was maybe up, it might be different. They may not have put two on the ball, but they felt like they had to try something. So it's going to be a kitchen sink game anyway. So we'll see what they tried out there.
I would hope I just don't think they can be that aggressive against Middleton. Like we've talked about it before. Like, he's not a guy that generates a bunch of separation on his own. Like, even if he's in a rhythm, it's generally because he's just knocking down shots with a hand in his face. And I think at a certain point, you know, I made the point earlier that Phoenix isn't taking anything away. Like, they have to try to do that. And with that, they have to kind of live with something. And you said earlier, like early in the series, like, they tried to live with him knocking down tough shots. Like, I think that's just kind of the formula with him, because he's not an advantage creator on his own.
No, I mean, I think the shots that Phoenix wanted to live with, Milwaukee knocked down almost every single one of them in game five. So it now becomes the question, can you still live with those? Can you make Milwaukee do it again? If they do it again, you're going home. So it's a tough spot there. How do you feel? This is the second straight game we've seen in a row. Milwaukee putting a little bullseye on Chris Paul. Not afraid to attack him on the other end. Not afraid to force him to switch onto Chris Middleton or Drew Holiday and look to get that post up, look to get to that ISO. How do we feel about that? A little seasoning from Budenholzer.
This has quietly been a pretty good, a pretty well-coached series from Mike Budenholzer. But to the Paul point, like, as smart as he is, as good of a defender as he still is at this stage, he's still the smallest man on the court. And so there's only so much you can do. Like, as you mentioned, like, Milwaukee has tried to seek him out on switches. It was interesting, like, watching the second half of that game. Missed it live, watched it earlier today. We're recording on a Sunday night. It was interesting to see, like, at a certain point in the second half, like, Chris Paul wasn't switching, or Phoenix didn't want to switch him. There was some show and recovers on, like, those wing pick and rolls where they're seeking him out. It's like, okay, they are really trying to take him out of the action. Like, they recognize that Milwaukee has identified Paul as a pressure point that they want to attack. So it's, I mean, it's smart on Milwaukee's point. Because, again, like, Paul may have the positioning, may be stronger than what you would think and stuff, but at the end of the day, he's still 6 foot on a good day. And if you get the Chris Middleton switch, he's able to shoot over the top. As you mentioned, Drew Holiday, as, you know, the efficiency has waned at certain points throughout the postseason run, the aggression has not. The rim pressure has been there just on pure drives and also those post-ups. He can get to his spots. He can shoot over the top of Chris Paul. So I don't know what more Phoenix can do to protect Paul. Again, they went to some show and recover sequences just to make sure that he isn't getting switched out into these matchups. Like, I think that's the right call to make if you can do that. Beyond that, I don't know how much help you want to send, because, again, like, this is a Milwaukee team throughout the postseason. Like, they found answers longer than we'd like, but they found answers. But generally, they haven't consistently created good looks for themselves. So if you get to the point to where you're feeding Milwaukee good looks with doubles or just hard shows and stuff like that, you're in rotation and you can't be in rotation against this team.
Because it's just not ideal, especially with their inability sometimes to generate movement. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've hammered Milwaukee time after time these playoffs about their process offensively, but there's a comfort in their play style. And we know how they want to play, and they're going to get to it at some point. And I think, this, again, they're finding ways to continue to attack the matchups Phoenix does not want to give them. And so for Phoenix, this is the toughest part. Mentally, you've got your season on the line. You have a scenario where a team is roaring with confidence, but they also are beating you in a way that you are, quote unquote, okay with being beat. So now mentally, can you trust what you've been doing, or do you feel the need to adjust? And that was one of my biggest concerns for Phoenix coming into game five. Will this affect them mentally? And you have a scenario where, you know, you lose the Devin Booker game, and now you come back home, you lose the 14 for 19 to start the first quarter game. Mm-hmm. Quickly, too. Thing flipped quick.
Yeah.
So this isn't necessarily one of those scenarios where they can go in the bag and find something to fix it. They have to play better on both ends of the floor. They have to refine their defense to be able to keep the ball in front, to be able to finish stops, to continue to contest and trust that that's going to work. And then offensively, I'm sure we'll get into it, they've got to find a way to get back to playing Phoenix Suns basketball. And salute to the Milwaukee Bucks, but they've kind of lost their way. And a lot of the compliments we've given Phoenix for this playoff run, we can now shift those to Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. Just because of how Milwaukee did it in game five. But again, tricky part is it took a lot of shot making. Like a lot of shot making. Even with that shot making, Phoenix was still hanging around.
Right.
And this is two games in a row where Phoenix has shot over 50%. So, but that's the tough part. Milwaukee only needs one more.
Mm-hmm.
So Phoenix can probably feel like, hey, we should have won the last two. You didn't. So how do you, how do you handle that? How do you receive that? It's hard to say, hey, we just need to keep doing what we're doing when what you're doing has got you down 3-2 now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the most interesting part for me.
And as we kind of shift to Milwaukee's defense, it's just weird to like watch what Milwaukee attempted to accomplish against like Devin Booker in particular. And like, he has 40, but like, you don't scoff at a 40 point performance, but it didn't feel like Devin Booker dictated a bunch in game five. And maybe I'm off on that, but it didn't feel like he really dictated the flow with his 40. He also made tough shots. It didn't feel like he really bent Milwaukee in a real way.
Well, I mean, let's just go right into it. Because one of my questions I was going to have is, how did you feel about Phoenix's offensive flow? In the first quarter, they looked like Phoenix. They looked like they were actually generating quality looks. They were attacking what Milwaukee was trying to do help-wise. They were finding the seams, attacking in transition. It felt like at some point, I want to say it was in the third quarter, they went heavy Devin Booker. And I want to say it was also at the end of the first, they also went heavy Devin Booker.
Mm-hmm.
And he, like you said, was scoring, but they were tough buckets. And the issue for Phoenix right now is Devin Booker making tough buckets is a good bridge for you. That's going to get you through some minutes. That's going to get you through a stretch, but it kind of has to be a bridge. It can't just be the thing. It can't become your offense. And it's clear Milwaukee's not at the point where they're going to feel pressure to think about changing how they're covering him. They feel pretty confident with the guys they have being able to get into his body, be physical, deny, fight over screens, contest shots. So now it's kind of like, what's the overall impact? Because even if we get Devin Booker going, it's not going to grow to a point where Milwaukee is so concerned that they put two on the ball. Which is usually what you hope. You hope Devin Booker gets going. Milwaukee, I don't want to say panics, but they adjust. Now you are able to run more things, open more things up. I think Milwaukee did it one time, I want to say, in game four. It didn't work, and I haven't seen them do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with, and I don't want to blame Devin Booker. I think I saw some of that earlier. Getting him going is taking the rhythm out of the offense.
Mm-hmm.
because he's having to work so hard to get the ball and then attack the seams and attack the space that Milwaukee's trying to take away. And it's just clear Milwaukee's not going to change their coverage. So they just got to do a better job of balancing that and continue with their flow while getting him going and then leaning on him and then getting back to their flow, because that's when they're tough. If it's just going to be Devin Booker, that gives Milwaukee a shot because we hope we can contest.
So like on that point, like it starts with Milwaukee. Like we've talked about a little bit with the way Jrue Holiday has been hounding Chris Paul in particular, basically off the inbound or whenever he gets past the opposite free throw line, like Holiday's there to pick him up or whoever's guarding Paul is there to pick him up. They're doing similar things to Devin Booker. Like I leaned to a possession late in the first quarter, like 1:45 left or so. I think it's Chris Paul. Is either Chris Paul or Campaign? I think it's Campaign bringing the ball up because Devin Booker is being denied. They wanted to inbound it to Booker to run whatever set they were going to go into, but he gets denied basically on the inbound. So Campaign has to bring it up. Booker finally gets free. By the time he catches, by the time he gets the ball, 17 on the clock. So it basically it took 6.5, 7 seconds to even get it across and get him the ball. He goes pick and roll. Giannis switches out onto him. And then he's just pounding it. He attacks Giannis in ISO, hits a ridiculous step back jumper over him. And it's a great shot. It's Devin Booker knocking down a step back mid-range jumper over Giannis after forcing a switch. But I just look at that possession like, this is kind of the problem. Like, not Booker in particular, because he's been very good at the shot making. But it's the process to getting Booker the ball. Like, as you said, it takes so much for him to even touch it, much less create a look that makes sense. So, like, Milwaukee has taken, has helped take Phoenix out of the rhythm. Again, that full court pressure or three quarters court pressure is slowing Phoenix down more than they want to. And then at that point, it's they're one action and done. It's one action in isolation. And like you just said, like Milwaukee can deal with contesting a tough shot. If it goes in, it goes in. But from a process standpoint, this is what they want. You don't want Phoenix becoming the buzzsaw that they were like in the Denver series in particular, where they just ran every variation of pick and roll you could think of and just carved you up and kept you in rotation. If it's just keep things in front and see if they miss, like Milwaukee's going to live with that.
We have to give Milwaukee credit. And we talked about how that shift happened with the consistent pressure, what that has done to Phoenix's offense, how it's bogged them down. I think even having PJ Tucker, I think a couple of times he pressured Devin Booker when he brought the ball up the court, because I think people felt that was an adjustment Phoenix could make. But especially when you combine Phoenix leaning heavy Devin Booker, you combine him getting full court pressure. Now there's 15 on the clock when he comes off a screen. You don't have anything else to go to. You're not playing outside of the play. So that's been their problem for the last two, three games, is getting into the flow and staying in it consistently and putting that pressure on. They came out in the first quarter and they had their pace and tempo going. They were getting their action started with 20 on the clock. They were playing out of it and putting pressure on Milwaukee. Then as the game went on, the pressure wore on the clock. They were fighting it and they lost their rhythm. They lost their flow. And I think it's interesting here as we talk about Devin Booker, what Milwaukee has done is A, taken sets off the table for Phoenix, which is, I don't want to say limited the playbook, but limited the impact of some of the plays they have run. And they've been able to get to it with multiple lineups. So whether it's the starting lineup, whether it's the double big lineup, whether it's Giannis at the five, they're able to defend and stay consistent with what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And that's made things tough. I mean, we talk about the full court pressure. Look at the impact it's had on DeAndre Ayton. His screens are so much higher on the floor right now. Mm-hmm. That it's not having the same juice. It's not having the same impact. It's not putting the same pressure on the defense. He's rolling into the drop.
Yeah.
It's Brook Lopez there. He's rolling into him as opposed to rolling into space, forcing help, being able to kick. That's a little thing. You know, and then I'm sure we'll talk about Chris Paul in a second, but you have to salute Milwaukee for being able to dig in. Like, that's not an easy way to play. And they've been able to get after it, playing heavy minutes for three games in a row. Just got to do it one more time.
Right. And it's a great point you made about them being able to have consistent defensive impact regardless of the lineups that they're throwing out. Like, I'm watching, you know, Phoenix try to go to double drag. If Giannis is at the five, like, they're switching both. If it's a traditional lineup, it's switching the first screen, dropping in the second. And depending on where they're starting that action, like you mentioned, like, it's Ayton rolling to the drop. Like, the way that they defended 1-5 pick and rolls in general was impressive to me. Like, they'd switch depending, like, if it's Tucker on Chris Paul, they're switching it. If it's not, then they're in the drop and you have help at the elbows to kind of crowd Chris Paul. And, you know, Ayton is not rolling into open space. And if they are switching and Ayton gets a smaller guy, like, not only is, you know, Milwaukee's kind of, they're staying consistent with fronting and then dropping a guy from the corner just to have some extra help. But a few instances in game five to where they're switching smaller guys onto Ayton, and in the middle of the front, they're also scram switching and getting a bigger guy on Ayton. And so it's odd to say that Ayton, it may seem odd on the surface to say Ayton was defended well in a game where he had a deficient 20-10, but they really did a good job of taking away easy looks. Like, the buckets that Ayton got off offensive rebounds or just jump hooks that, honestly, Milwaukee's fine with living with. So I think they have just done a great job of taking Phoenix out of rhythm. Like, they're not themselves right now.
No, and Milwaukee, I mean, we talked about it earlier, but these are things that Milwaukee feels like they can live with. We can live with Ayton rolling into the defense, Ayton switching, and us being able to match up out of it. It has not gotten to a point where Milwaukee feels like we have to switch things up or we have to send more attention that way, which is a lot different than the first two games of the series. I mean, even Ayton had a few slips, but it's still not consistent. It's not a thing where Milwaukee's saying, hey, we're not going to switch. You know, they'll still switch Jeff Teague onto Ayton, which should tell you where they're at defensively with the mindset. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Chris Paul a little bit. They're not giving him any room to operate. That ball pressure is taking him out of his spots and out of his rhythm. And in the first couple games, he was able to do a good job of still get to his spots, mix in the rejects, you know, drive one way, come back off the screen. Can't do it now. I thought he did a good job of the first quarter of this game of helping set the table, making Milwaukee pay, and putting pressure on them, you know, because they want to help at the nail. So, hey, drive, kick to Crowder, get a three, find those gaps, make them pay. That start of the second quarter, Chris Paul was getting in the paint. He was doing his part. Mm-hmm. He was forcing help. Those shots weren't falling. And from that point on, there felt like there was a shift. Not to say necessarily that he played poorly, but it felt like it wasn't the same kind of attack. And you look, who is he supposed to attack? Milwaukee has found something for Brook Lopez defensively, mm-hmm, to where he feels comfortable executing, and they're just not giving Chris Paul the space to get to his pull-up. They have felt very comfortable over this three-game stretch switching Bobby Portis onto Chris Paul and living with the result. And Giannis has been a menace against Chris Paul, it feels like,
for
three games straight as far as, I'm not giving you your shot. So he's running out of people to use to attack. Mm-hmm. And he's got Jrue Holiday to deal with, PJ Tucker, like just multiple bodies, multiple space. And I think one of the other things that full court pressure is doing is it's just kind of taking him out of his rhythm in the sense that now they're setting, we talked about Ayton, higher screens, but now it almost feels like he has to drive. So now he's trying to drive full speed to beat the pressure, and he's either driving the defense or kicking. That takes something out of you. You know, the pressure is one thing, but if now the pressure is forcing you to go ahead and hit that turbo button a little bit more than you usually do, mm-hmm, it's not the same measured game from Chris Paul. It's not the same data collection from Chris Paul. Mm-hmm. It's there's no space. Where am I supposed to go? How do we mix this up? So that's going to be interesting because they have to find a way to get him loose. He's going to have to get going. But I don't know if he can. I shouldn't say he can. I don't know if Milwaukee is at the point where they will bend against any of those guys right now. Mm-hmm. They're gonna live with the pull-up and contest.
Yeah, and I think that shift came, I want to say, game three, in which Milwaukee was playing a lot of the extra, like they start the series switching, and even when they went to drop, it felt very much like a 2-on-2 endeavor for Milwaukee.
Oh, well, I mean, they started the series trying everything.
Yeah, that's true. But but once they started showing more help at the nail and at the elbows and more stunts on these drives and stuff, like, that just, again, it contributes to throwing off the rhythm. Because you can't just snake off the pick, two dribbles, and pull up comfortably. You're worrying about an extra pair of hands at this point. You add that to full court pressure, you have more to think about. And to your point, like, Paul is speeding up the court more often. And he wants to walk it up, survey what's going on, then make plays. If you're rushing him, he's still a really good player, but that's not his comfort zone. And I did notice, like, in the second half, when he was able to get downhill, it was less getting into the pull-up, consistently anyway. It was less getting into the pull-up, and it's a deeper paint drive, and then it's a probe to the other side of the rim, trying to pull out the big and see if he can draw that kind of switch against the Brook Lopez, or if it isn't there, see if he can wrap around and take a turnaround jumper there. Like, he's not getting the normal left elbow look if he's starting to pick and roll and snaking that way, or the right elbow look or whatever. He's not in his wheelhouse, because again, it's Chris Paul. He can make shots from wherever, but it's not his comfort zone right now. And then, you know, again, that pressure, the extra help he has to navigate, how hard he's working to get looks, the comfort with Milwaukee switching means he has to do more ISO, which is more dribbling, more shot creation. Then you go back to the other end and he's being hunted defensively. That's a lot for a 36-year-old to be tasked with running the offense when Devin Booker doesn't have it going, or he's on the bench for, you know, the 6 minutes that he's going to be on the bench. You're also tasked with being the guy during that stretch. And then on the other end, you're constantly being hunted. Like, that's, fatigue sets in at a certain point. So I don't know how he bends the defense. Because, I mean, Milwaukee has mixed in a little bit of everything against him. Like, they've switched him, you know, with Portis in particular. If they're playing drop, like, Brook Lopez has played the drop a little bit higher and then drops back. So he doesn't even get the early automatic look there. Milwaukee's also showing more help. So even if he wants to get to the elbow, he's going to have to shoot over someone. And he can make those shots because he's Chris Paul. But comfort level just isn't there. And if Chris Paul isn't comfortable and Devin Booker is dropping 40 against a defense that isn't bending, and Milwaukee is living with whatever Ayton does, it just kind of adds up at a certain point. Like, Milwaukee just isn't scared of them or scared of anything that they want to do right now.
Well, I mean, the crazy part is this is still a team that scored 119 points, shot 55% from the field, 68% from three. And we're talking about them like they're done. But that speaks to me of how high of a level Phoenix has played at offensively during these playoffs. And it speaks to me how high of a level Milwaukee's playing defensively right now. To be able to come on here and speak into a microphone that Chris Paul doesn't have the multiple options that he normally does in pick and roll sounds insane. But that's kind of what we're seeing. And the mixed coverages, as you spoke of, are having an impact because Phoenix has done such a great job of finding different actions to attack your exploit. But if everything changes, depending on the lineups or the personnel or who's in it, it's hard to necessarily pinpoint the exact one thing that's going to get you in that rotation that's going to attack you in that way. And now you throw in the pressure, you throw in the pace, you throw in the tempo, you throw in, hey, we generated a good look early. It didn't fall. Now Milwaukee goes and score. Hey, we did it again. That one didn't fall either. It's a quick run. So now you're trying to slow it back down. Let's try and execute something. Now you find yourself in that yin yang. It just has not felt like since those first two games, they have been able to consistently play their game offensively. You know, you look 48 field goals, 23 assists, not horrible. Not the Phoenix we saw against Denver. Not the Phoenix we saw in the wins against the Clippers. So they have to find a way to get it done on that end. I'm going to take a question that we asked about a different Suns player and flip it.
Yeah.
DeAndre Ayton, more important, his offense or his defense?
I think it's the defense for him. A, because like he, from a physical standpoint, he's the only guy that has a shot against Giannis. And Giannis has beasted on him too. But he's the only guy that has a physical shot against Giannis. Beyond that, he's their only rim protector, period. Like, even when their big man rotation was healthy, like, Sarge is a guy a little bit more comfortable playing higher up, using some activity there, or just switching out. Frank Kaminsky is just not good at defense. So, like, Ayton is the guy that can perform in a drop, can play higher if necessary, can switch if necessary. Like, he's easily their best option defensively. So if Ayton isn't providing that, Milwaukee just has no shot defending the rim, ending possessions. And then if Ayton is in foul trouble, the alternatives are worse. So I think it's the defense for him. Because, I mean, again, he had 20 and 10 in this game, and I feel like Milwaukee defended him well, and it also didn't feel like he really affected. I mean, he didn't scare Milwaukee at all from a scheme perspective either.
DeAndre Ayton's defense is very interesting to me in this series. Giannis, the matchup, it's tough at times for him to catch the drive. He's had some foul issues, but he's also contested a few shots. Giannis has made some. Quick side note before I continue on this point. Salute to the Bucks for committing to Giannis in that side ISO through the doubles. And then when Phoenix went small, committing to just going to the post and saying, go ahead, Giannis, go ahead. So salute to them for that. Back to DeAndre Ayton. If you recall before the playoffs, I was concerned about DeAndre Ayton's defense, how it would hold up in the playoffs, and he has exceeded every expectation I had. I apologize to him. I think every series they won. And now the irony here is Milwaukee's feasting on the drop, and it's not even necessarily, I don't even feel like it's the drop's fault. They're just making the shots. Like, I feel like they made a bunch of shots over Ayton. And it's on one hand, it's like, is he impacting the ball handler? On the other hand, it's how many of these can they make? And so I don't watching it, I haven't had the same feel as if DeAndre Ayton has to come higher, even though maybe he does. But at some point, he's got to be ready earlier. It kind of feels like he's back there and then he goes into a contest instead of being there and then contesting. It's a slight difference. So it'll be interesting to see. You mentioned the other alternatives being bad for Phoenix. Small lineups. Secret sauce for Phoenix is that they don't really have a small lineup. And here's the trickiest part about Phoenix with their small lineup. They can't execute the same as their regular team. Even when they put Torrey Craig in as a roller, it's not the same mix. It's not the same effort. It's not the same execution. And it feels, that small lineup just feels kind of one-dimensional on both ends of the floor. Feels like they end up taking a lot of quick shots. I forget, just throw that out there.
Yeah, it's fair. Like, on one hand, like, they don't really have the personnel to go small for the reason that you mentioned. And the other part of that is if they're going small, they're either trying to go small against Milwaukee when they're playing their starters or going big, and that's an obvious issue from a rebounding perspective, from a paint perspective, or they're going against Milwaukee's version of small ball, in which Giannis is the five and he towers over literally everyone. So, like, Phoenix doesn't have the personnel for themselves, and it's also a terrible matchup for them on a small ball perspective, because Milwaukee small ball is still huge because Giannis is just an absolute force on both ends of the floor. So it also kind of brings apart, you know, how valuable Ayton is or should be, because he's the one semblance of a counter that Phoenix has to the Milwaukee paint problem, or the Giannis paint problem in particular. And if he isn't making an impact there, what can you do?
Well, I think offensively they missed his impact as well as far as being a roller, because his roles open up looks for Crowder, Bridges, and company. And if it's a switch mostly, or Brooks in a drop, or he's having to set it higher, it's different. That takes that off the table. So now that becomes less of a threat, and a roster that is built on execution, built on team ball, built on IQ, shot making. the less things they have on the table, the tougher it becomes from the generate. I mean, you saw Mikal Bridges coming off pick and roll the other game. I think he took a pull up three. Mm-hmm. It was like, huh, interesting. I mean, that's where they may have to go. So Phoenix offensively, the balance, it feels like, is either we got to get some shot making, we got to get some stops and some easy ones, or we have to find some, we have to refine that pressure point, put that pressure on Brook in a drop or attack Bobby Portis in a switch and find something that's going to make Milwaukee flinch and get back to having multiple options on the table. I think that's going to be the big key for game six. I'm podding today. What you got?
Oh, you are. You're crushing it like you always do. It's an obvious thing to say with Phoenix down 3-2. Like, of course, this is a problem for them. But, like, this is such a... Like, the rim issue for Phoenix, particularly on the offensive end of the floor, but the rim issue for Phoenix coming to a head on the back end of the finals, like, it just couldn't happen at a worse time. Because, again, like, as good as Phoenix has been all year long, particularly on the offensive end, like, they've been one of the best half-court offenses in the league. They don't push often in transition, but when they do, they've been effective at it. They're just not a team that gets to the rim a ton. And I keep going back to that with Milwaukee now. A, they're coming into the series knowing that they want to live on those mid-rangers. They want to knock down threes if Ayton, who is their rim pressure guy, basically as a roller, Ayton opens up those looks for driving kicks and for kickouts, and you get threes that way. With Milwaukee taking that away, that's kind of it. And if Ayton's on the floor, like, nobody else can even replicate that kind of rim pressure, that kind of vertical threat. And so it just feels like Phoenix is kind of stuck in the mud at this point. And I don't know, you know, from a literal roster standpoint, like, I don't think they have a counter, really. They can't really go small. And, like, the big that they have healthy behind Ayton, A, doesn't do what Ayton does. Like, Frank Kaminsky is very much a pick-and-pop big. And he's also just not anywhere close as good as Ayton. So there's just a dramatic drop-off there. So I just struggle to see where Phoenix goes from here.
Again, this is the same Phoenix team that played well offensively, yeah. Even as we say all this, and
right.
Legit loss because of a terrible second quarter and unbelievable shooting from Middleton, Giannis, and Drew.
Yeah.
But that's the line. That's where we're at. I mean, and that's where, you know, that's a tough game to swallow. Those are two tough games to swallow because – right. This could easily be flipped. And I don't even know if it's, I mean, I can't say it's not strategic because we just went over strategy for the last 40 minutes, but it's one of those things where it doesn't feel like it's broken. Mm-hmm. But how do you feel that way after you lose three straight? Like, so it's tough. It's tough. But
to your point, that's just kind of the breaks of playoff basketball sometimes. Like, I think it's very clear what Milwaukee wants to accomplish on both ends and what they're willing to live with. And it's up to Phoenix to make enough shots within that wheelhouse or get enough stops on the other end within that wheelhouse to win. And so, as you mentioned, like, you know, Phoenix offensively, you know, 119 points, shot well from the field, shot well from three. Didn't shoot well from the free throw. Well, didn't get to the free throw line often. But again, that's just part of who Phoenix is as an offensive team. They don't get to the rim a ton. So they executed, or they performed as about as high a level as you can, considering their profile and what Milwaukee's taken away. And that's the high end version, and they lost. Could have won, but they lost. So, like, now it's what is the counter if you're going to go to it? And you mentioned earlier talking about Phoenix, like, they have to play better. How much better can they play?
They could play a lot better defensively.
Oh, I mean, I mean mostly offensively.
Offensively? Oh, they could play better. You have to move the ball. Like, you have to get back. The first quarter happened for a reason. It was an accident. So they've done it. They did it the game before in the first and third quarters. They have to sustain that no matter who's on the floor, no matter who's out there from Milwaukee. If you know Giannis is going to be switching, don't put him in action. Put Bobby Portis in action. Mm-hmm. It can continue to guard. Try and get by him. Drive and kick. Move the ball more. You know, get to your slips, your back cuts. Get into your offense earlier. There's things they can do because they've done it. The problem is they get worn down. They get bogged down. And it don't work. So they have to sustain what they've been doing. Speaking of sustaining, Pat Connaughton. Who, buddy?
He's doing the thing. Like, he's been very key point. Like, if I have the stat correct, let's do some quick math.
Man's 50% from three in the finals. Averaging three makes a game. Basic stats, but still. Man's made two or more threes in his last six playoff games. This man's about to be a Bucks legend.
Pat Connaughton. Serving on the bench. 15 bench points for Phoenix in game five. 14 for Connaughton. That can't happen if you're Phoenix. A very basic point, but like...
The secret is they have not been able to play him off the floor in these three games. They've not been able to punish him at a level that makes Milwaukee flinch or makes Milwaukee think twice or makes Milwaukee take him out. And he's important to that small lineup. They have to have him as a piece shooting wise. Mm-hmm. So salute to him.
He's competing. Like, I got yelled at on the last pod. Like, I think he's been pretty good defensively over the past few games.
I'm not going to do it again, but he did get some buckets served up to him. It's not to the point where Milwaukee's going to make a difference, but they did attack him in the first two games. He's made that shift. Salute to him.
Salute to him is the good for him?
No, salute to him. Oh, you're not going to get me.
I'm just asking questions. I don't know. It just sounds familiar. I don't know.
Nah, hashtag still big call, man.
Yeah, I don't know who to give you that. It's fine though. It's fine.
But when they go to a full court trap, beat it with ball movement.
Oh man. But yeah, to that point, like again, I've been yelled at. It's fine. Like, I think he's contested Devin Booker pretty well. Booker's knocked down some tough shots over him. Like, I don't think he's been lost on defense. And to the earlier point, going back to the Chris Paul conversation, that Chris Paul has tried to seek, like, Bobby Portis and Pat Connaughton are the two guys that Chris Paul has tried to pick on. And like, Portis has held his own on switches, and he hasn't really been able to bait Pat Connaughton. Like, Connaughton's just kind of been there. And if Connaughton can hold serve and then knock down timely threes, can't even call him timely at this point with the kind of volume and efficiency that he's shooting the three ball with. But if he's able to knock down those shots on the other end, can operate as an inverted screener for Giannis at times just to sow even more confusion into Phoenix's defense and mix it up that way, you can't play him off. And if you can't play him off, Milwaukee can go small. And as we just talked about, like, Phoenix doesn't have a small ball counter, really. Actually, a quick Giannis question for you now that I'm thinking about it. Like, how have you felt about, because I wrote about it heading into the series, like, I wanted to know what the inverted pick and rolls are going to look like in this series. Because it's been kind of a mixed bag throughout the postseason when they've had a guard screen for him. Like, how have you felt about the Giannis-Chris pick and roll in particular? Because that's not a wrinkle I expected to see often.
And that's why I already gave my Giannis-Chris pick and roll point. Don't worry about it. I'll repeat myself. Don't worry about it. No, the big difference has been the fact that they have used what Phoenix doesn't want to do as far as who's guarding him, if it's Cam Johnson or if it's Chris Paul. and use that show and recover in different ways. I think the biggest one for me was Giannis had it at the top of the key. Chris Middleton came up the middle of the floor and he set a flat screen. So Giannis could go either way. It's a lot tougher for Bridges to get to a show and recover. And now you put more pressure on the defense. Even if it's Chris Middleton screening for Giannis as he brings the ball up, I think on the left side of floor, he had one. The whole left side was clear. So Giannis could just drive and get downhill. That makes a difference. So for me, it's been the combination of the different spots they've used them in. They haven't just done middle pick and roll to death. They've actually mixed different things in, and they've actually looked to have an impact to attack Phoenix by attacking their pressure points or allowing their guys to get downhill. That's what I've enjoyed, because it's not a switch when they go to it. Mm-hmm. And that's been the big problem for me. It's either been those two screening and it's a switch, so what'd you get out of it? Or it's just been a middle pick and roll where there's no real roll. You know, Middleton pops, but you know, he didn't really get the separation. So I think the way they've used it, the timing of them using it, has been important for the success.
All right. I appreciate you for repeating your point on Chris Giannis.
I was just joking, man.
Well, I take it back. Very cool. So are all hearts and minds clear about this series? I'm just ready to watch game six. I want to see where that goes. Because game six in Milwaukee.
Oh, Lord.
Look, man, if we get a Chris Middleton game in game six and Milwaukee pulls that off, like, I apologize in advance.
PTO day for me.
That's fine. I'll run the pod solo. I will intro myself. I will interview myself. That's fine.
I got a pre-recorded one for you. Don't worry about it. I'll send you the file.
Is this going to be salute to him?
No, I'm just going to be there for the intro. That's it.
Wow.
We'll embrace your bounce and then...
Just gonna be me talking about Chris Middleton. Just gonna break down all of his shot attempts. It's gonna be great.
Oh Lord,
this is what the people come for, you know. It's not, but it will be that day.
Is it though?
Yeah, it's gonna depend on the result on Tuesday night.
That crowd's gonna be insane. The Deer District. It's gonna be deering it up.
Deer, you discovering what the Deer District is called has been one of my favorite subplots of this podcast, I must say.
I had no idea.
Just shout out to the Deer District.
There's more and more of them every game.
Yeah, I mean, you get close to the title. I get it.
And shout out to Milwaukee Brewers. They moved their baseball game out the way. They said, we're going to play in the afternoon.
I respect it. Recognize where your city's going. Like, baseball plays like 400 games a year anyway. Like, just move. You know, you can move the time slot. It's fine.
Shout out to Team USA for defeating Spain. Held them to 76 points. The defense is back. Keldon Johnson, 15 points.
This is a Keldon Johnson fan account. This is a Keldon Johnson podcast. Don't give me the face. You know how often I've talked about Keldon Johnson on this pod. The Spurs have been a team of the week multiple times. Keldon's been a player that's caught by eye multiple times. This is very much a Keldon podcast. We have to get Keldon on the podcast. We got to try to make that happen.
I don't know what to do with any of that.
Is that going to be a PTO day for you as well?
That seems like DeMar DeRozan slander.
You know what? On that note, thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe. We are on Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcast, we are there. You can find me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can find Steve at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all later this week.
Do you see Space Jam 2? Why was LeBron at the finals game?